ferry fare. "Best I can do for now," she said. "Turkey sub sound all right?" "Marry me," I responded, tore into the food with fervor, and spent a couple of minutes indulging in one of the purest primal pleasures, eating. Food never tastes so good as when you are starving, and Talos had granted me a safe passport under the Accords, so I wasn't worried about any drugs in it. While I ate, the girl drew a short stand over to her, on which was a clay bust of a young woman, parts of it still rough, still marked with the tracks of her fingers. She dipped them into a bowl of water attached to the stand and started working on the bust. "What happened to her?" she asked. "Hell if I know," I said, between bites. "She was in my car like that. Wanted me to bring her here." "Why did you?" she flushed. "I mean, you're working for Summer's enemies, right?"
"Yeah, but it doesn't mean I'm friendly with them."
I shook my head, washed down a half-chewed bite with a long drink of Coke. Heaven. I ate for a moment more and then frowned at the bust she was working on. The face seemed familiar. I studied it a bit and then asked, "Is that Lily?" The girl blinked at me.
"You know her?"
"Of her," I said. "She's a changeling, isn't she?" The girl nodded. "Winter, but she hasn't chosen to go over to them. She was under Ronald's protection, and she models for us sometimes." She gestured vaguely toward the young man who was painting intently. "See, there are a few other pieces she modeled for around here." I looked around the garden and picked out a pair of statues among all the rest. Both were nudes of white marble. One of them depicted a girl in a tiptoe stretch, arms over her head, body arched prettily. The other showed her kneeling, looking at something cupped in her hands, her expression one of quiet sadness. "Seems like she's well-liked," the girl nodded. "She's very gentle, very sweet." "Very missing," I said. She frowned.
"Missing?"
"Yeah. Her roommate asked me to see if I could find her. Have you seen her in the last couple of days?"
"She hasn't been here to model, and I never see her anywhere but here. I'm sorry."
"It's worth a shot," I said.
"Why are you looking for her?"
"I told you, her roommate asked for my help. I gave it."
Which was mostly true. Technically, I suppose. I'd sold it.
I got the uneasy feeling that I might start feeling too guilty over the cash Merrill had given me to spend it. I'm a tad busy this week, but I'll do what I can. The girl's brow furrowed as she worked at the bust.
"You're not like anyone else I've ever met who's working for Winter. Mab usually likes her agents colder, I think, hungrier, more cruel."
I shrugged. "She wanted someone to find a killer. I've had some experience." She nodded.
"Still, you seem like a decent enough person. Makes me sad to think you've gotten entangled in Winter's snares."
I stopped chewing and looked up at her hard. "Oh, hell's bells." She looked at me and lifted an eyebrow.
"Hmm?"
I put the sandwich down and said, "You're her. You're the summer lady." The shadow of a smile touched the girl's lips, and she bowed her head toward me. Her blonde hair cleared out to a she-white. Her fingers and limbs suddenly seemed slightly longer, and her features became almost identical to Mav's. Eyes vertically slitted and almost violently green. She still wore coveralls and blue t-shirt, and was still liberally covered with flecks of clay, though. They stood out in sharp contrast to her fair skin and pale hair.
"Call me Aurora," she said. "It's a little easier for everyone."
Right, I said. I finished the bite I was on and said, "So are you going to stop playing games with me and help Elaine, Aurora?" She glanced over at Elaine, lying on the ground, and her expression grew troubled. "That depends." My teeth clenched, and I said in a falsely pleasant voice,
"On what?"
She turned her calm, inhuman eyes to me.
"On you."
"Don't go getting specific on me now," I said. "I wouldn't know how to handle it."
"Do you think this is a joke, Mr. Dresden? A game?"
"I know damn well it isn't a game." She shook her head.
"And that is where you are wrong.
It is a game, but unlike the ones you know. You aren't allowed to know the rules to this game, and it was never intended to be fair. Do you know why Mab chose you, wizard?" I glared at her.
"No."
"Neither do I," she said. "And that is my part of the game."
"Why choose you?" It must be because she expects something from you that she would get from no one else. Perhaps bringing Ella here is what she expected.
What's the difference? I demanded. Elaine is hurt. Your emissary has been wounded in the line of duty. Don't you think you should get her moving again?
But if that is what Winter expects, it could be used against me. I am the least queen of summer, but even so, I must be cautious in the use of my power. I snorted.
Mav sure as hell doesn't think that way.
Oh, of course not, she said. She's Winter. She's violent, vicious, merciless.
And your centaur is just the soul of gentleness and understanding.
Aurora sighed and lowered her clay-crusted fingers. I hope you will forgive Korik's temper. He's usually a merrier sort. Everyone's been edgy because of matters here.
Uh-huh, I said. Just so we're clear, that was really mortal food, wasn't it?
Yes, she said. I have no desire to threaten your freedom, Mr. Dresden, or to bind you in any way.
Good.
I knew she couldn't lie to me, so I took another bite of the sandwich and some more chips.
Look, I'm not trying to undermine your power or sabotage Summer, Aurora. I just want you to help Elaine.
I know, she said. I believe you. But I don't trust you.
What reason do you have not to trust me?
I've watched you, she responded. You're a mercenary. You work for hire.
Yeah, to pay the bills, and
she lifted a hand. You've made bargains with demons.
Nickel and dime stuff, nothing huge, or
you've traded yourself to the Lianshith for power.
When I was younger, and a hell of a lot stupider, and in trouble.
Her inhuman eyes met mine, penetrating. You've killed. I looked away from her. There wasn't much to say. My stomach turned, and I pushed the food away a bit from me. Aurora nodded slowly. From the beginning, you have been meant to be a destroyer, a killer. Do you know the original purpose of a godparent, Mr. Dresden?
Yeah,
I said. I felt tired. A godparent was chosen to ensure that a child had religious and moral guidance and teaching.
Indeed, she said. And your godmother, your teacher and guide, is the most vicious creature of Mab's court. More than Mab's equal, second in strength only to Mab herself.
I let out a harsh laugh.
Teacher? Guide? Is that what you think Leah is to me?
Isn't she?
Leah barely noticed me except when she thought she could get something from me, I spat. The rest of the time she couldn't care less. The only thing she taught me was that if I didn't want to get walked on, I had to be smarter than her, stronger than her, and willing to do something about it.
Aurora turned her lovely face fully toward me and regarded me with deep, quiet eyes.
Yes.
Unease gnawed at my belly as she continued. The strong conquer, and the weak are conquered. That is Winter. That is what you have learned. She leaned closer and said quietly, emphatic, That is what makes you dangerous. Do you see? I stood up and walked a few paces away. Aurora didn't say anything. I heard drips of water as she washed her hands in the little bowl.
If you aren't going to help Elaine, tell me. I'll take her to the hospital.
Do you think I should help her?
I don't give a damn if you do or not, I said. But one way or another, I'm going to make sure that she's taken care of. Make up your mind.
I already have. What remains is for you to make up yours. I took a wary breath before asking.
Meaning?
Of the two people who entered this garden, Mr. Dresden, Elaine is not the most grievously wounded. You are.
Like hell. I've just got some cuts and bruises.
She rose and walked toward me. Those aren't the wounds, I mean. She reached out and laid a slender hand over my heart. Her skin was warm, even through my shirt, and the simple fact of her touch brought me a small but noticeable sense of comfort. Susan had been gone for months, and with the exception of the occasional assault, no one had actually touched me. She looked up at me and nodded.
You see, you've been badly wounded, Mr. Dresden, and you have found neither rest nor respite from your pains.
I'll live.
True, she said.
But this is where it always begins. Monsters are born of pain and grief and loss and anger. Your heart is full of them. I shrugged.
And?
And it makes you vulnerable. Vulnerable to Mab's influence, to temptations that would normally be unthinkable.
I'm handling temptation pretty damn well, thank you.
But for how long? You need to heal, wizard. Let me help you.
I frowned at her and at her hand. How?
Aurora gave me a small, sad smile. I'll show you.
Here.
Her palm pressed a bit closer to me, and somewhere inside me, a dam broke open. Emotions welled up like a riotous rainbow. Scarlet rage, indigo fear, pale blue sadness, aching yellow loneliness, putrid green guilt. The tide flooded through me, coursing over me like a bolt of lightning, searing and painful and beautiful all at once. After the tide receded, a deep, quiet stillness followed. A sensation of warmth suffused me, gently easing away my aches and bruises. It spread over my skin like sunlight on a lazy afternoon outside, and with the warmth, my cares began to evaporate. My fear vanished, and I began to relax muscles I hadn't realized were stretched tight as the warmth spread. I floated in warmth for a time, the release from pain, an ecstasy in itself. When I came back to my senses, I was lying on my back on the grass, staring up at leaves and silver-starred sky. My head lay in Aurora's lap. She knelt beside me, and her hands rested lightly, warm and soft, along the sides of my face. The pain began to return to my body, thoughts, and heart, like some quiet and odious tide washing in garbage from a polluted sea. I heard myself make a small sound of protest. Aurora looked down at me, her eyes concerned. Worse even than I suspected. You didn't even realize how much pain you were in, did you? My chest heaved, and I let out a quiet sob. The warmth faded entirely, and the sheer weight of the difficulties I had to face pressed down on me, suffocating me. Aurora said, "Please let me help you."
"We'll make it a bargain, Mr. Dresden. Desist. Relax your efforts to help Winter. Stay here for a time, and let me grant you a measure of peace."
Real tears formed, making my vision blur. I mopped at my face with my hands, struggling to think clearly. If I took the deal, it would probably mean my ass. Backing off from Mab's offer would mean that I didn't get a good outcome for the White Council, which meant that they would buy peace with the Red Court of Vampires for the low, low price of one Harry Dresden, slightly damaged.
"Forget it," I said, my voice weak. "I've got a job to do."
Aurora closed her eyes for a moment and nodded. "At least you are true to your word, Mr. Dresden. Your honor is admirable, even if it is misguided." I forced myself to sit up, away from Aurora.
"Go on," I said. "Help Elaine."
"I will," she assured me, "but she is in no danger for the moment, and it will take some time. There is something I wish to say to you first."
"Okay, talk."
"How much did Mab tell you about Ronald's death?"
I shook my head. "That he was dead? That the mantle of power he wore went missing? That the killer had to be found?"
"Did she tell you why?"
I frowned. "Not exactly."
Aurora nodded and folded her hands in her lap. "Summer readies to go to war against Winter." I frowned.
"You mean it's not just a theoretical possibility anymore? It's real?"
"I know no other kind of war. The loss of the summer night has forced Summer's hand."
"I'm not sure I follow."
Her pale brow knit into a soft frown. "The power of our nights is considerable. It carries a sort of weight that only a free mortal will can possess. That power, that influence, is a critical element of the balance between our courts."
"Except now yours is gone."
"Exactly."
"Which makes Summer weaker."
"Yes."
I nodded.
"Then why the hell are you planning an attack?" "The seasons are changing," Aurora said. In 2 days' time, midsummer will be upon us, the height of summer strength. She said nothing more, letting me do the math.
You think winter has taken away your night, I said, and if you wait, you're only going to grow more and more weak while winter gets stronger, right?
Correct. If we are to have any chance of victory, we must strike while at the peak of our strength. It will be the only time when our court might be near equal to winter's strength. Otherwise, the seasons will change, and at midwinter, Mab and her creatures will come for us, and they will destroy us, and with us, the balances of the mortal world. She lifted her green eyes from her hands to my face.
Winter, Mr. Dresden. Endless winter. Unending and vicious cycles of predator and prey. Such a world would not be kind to mortals. I shook my head.
Why would winter pull this now? I mean, if they had waited another couple of days, they could have held all the cards. Why leave you enough space to wriggle out?
I cannot pretend to know the mind of winter, Aurora said, but I know they must not be allowed to destroy us, for your sake as well as ours.
Boy, everybody's looking out for my best interests.
Wizard, please, promise me that you will do what you can to stop them.
I'm finished making promises. I stood up and started for the path that led back to the elevator and out, but part of me wanted to do nothing but return to the comfort Aurora had offered. I paused and squeezed my eyes shut, focusing my resolve. But I will say this. I'm going to find the killer and straighten this out, and I'm going to do it before midsummer. I didn't bother to add, because I'm as good as dead if I don't. No need to belabor the obvious.
Chapter 18. I got the hell away from the Rothschild and found a payphone. Murphy picked up on the first ring.
Dresden?
Yeah.
Finally! You all right?
I need to talk to you. There was a short pause, and then her voice softened.
Where?
I rubbed at my head with the heel of one hand, trying to nudge my brain into gear. My thoughts stumbled around sluggishly, in no particular order.
Don't know. Someplace public. Bunch of people. Quiet enough to talk.
In Chicago? At this time of night?
Yeah.
Okay, Murphy said. I guess I know a place. She told me. We agreed to meet in 20 minutes and hung up. As I pulled into the parking lot, I reflected that odds were that not a lot of clandestine meetings involving mystical assassination, theft of arcane power, and the balance of power in the realms of the supernatural had taken place in a Walmart supercenter. But then again, maybe they had. Hell, for all I knew, the mole men used the changing rooms as a place to discuss plans for world domination with the psychic jellyfish from Planet X and the disembodied brains in a jar from Klaatua Nebula. I know I wouldn't have looked for them there. After midnight, the Walmart wasn't crowded, but it wasn't the usual deserted parking lot you'd expect after hours around Wrigleyville, either. The store was open all night, and there were plenty of people in a town like Chicago who would do their shopping late. I had to park about halfway down a row and walk through the cool of the evening before stepping into the refrigerator cold of the enormous store, whose massive air conditioners had too much momentum to slow down for a few paltry hours of darkness. A greeter nodded sleepily to me as I came in, and I passed up his offer of a shopping cart. Before I'd gotten all the way into the store, Murphy fell into step beside me. She was wearing a Cubs jacket, jeans, and sneakers, and she had her blonde hair tucked up underneath an undecorated black ball cap. She walked with her hands in her pockets, and her expression, one of belligerent annoyance, didn't seem to fit on someone that short. Wordlessly, we walked past all the hole-in-the-wall franchise businesses, closed and locked up behind their grills, and settled down at the generic cafe near the deli section of the grocery store. Murphy chose a booth where she could watch the door, and I sat across from her where I could watch her back. She picked up a couple of cups of coffee, bless her noble heart. I dumped sugar and creamer into mine until bits floated on the surface, stirred it up, and took a slow sip that nearly scalded my tongue.
"You don't look so good," Murphy said.
I nodded.
"You want to talk about it?"
To my surprise, I did. I set the coffee down and said, without preamble,
"I'm furious, Murph. I can't think straight. I'm so mad."
"Why?" Because I'm screwed, that's why. No matter what I do, I'm going to take it up the ass. Lines appeared between her eyebrows. What do you mean? It's this job, I said. Investigating rules death. There's a lot of resistance, and I don't even know if I can beat it. And if I don't beat it before tomorrow night, things are really going to go to hell. The client isn't being helpful? I let out a bitter laugh. Hell, for all I know, the client is doing this to me just so I can get myself horribly killed. You don't trust them, then? Not as far as I could kick her. And the people who are supposed to be working with me are driving me nuts. I shook my head. I feel like some guy in a magician's box just before he starts pushing all kinds of swords through it. Only it's not a trick, and the swords are real, and they're going to start skewering me any second. The bad guys are doing their best to get me wiped out or screwed up. The good guys think I'm some kind of ticking psycho just waiting to go off, and it's like pulling teeth to get a straight answer out of any of them. You think you're in danger? I know it, I said, and it's just too damn big. I fell quiet for a moment and sipped my coffee. So, Murph said, why do you want to see me? Because the people who should be backing me up are about to throw me to the wolves. And because the only person actually helping me is green enough to get himself killed without a babysitter. I set the empty cup down. And because when I asked myself who I could trust, I came up with a damn short list. You're it. She settled back in her seat with a slow, long exhalation. You're going to tell me what's going on? If you're willing, I said. I know I've kept things from you, but I've done it because I thought that's how I could protect you best, because I didn't want you to get hurt. Yeah, she said. I know. It's annoying as hell. I tried to smile. In this case, ignorance is bliss. If I tell you this stuff, it's going to be serious. Just knowing it could be dangerous for you, and you aren't going to be able to get away from it, Murph. Not ever. She regarded me soberly. Then why tell me now? Because you deserve to know, long since. Because you've risked your life for me, to protect people from all the supernatural crud that's out there. Because being around me has brought you trouble, and knowing more about it might help you if it comes your way again. My cheeks flushed, and I admitted, and because I need your help. This is a bad one, I'm afraid. I'm not going anywhere, Harry. I gave her a tired smile. One last thing. If you come in on this, you have to understand something. You have to promise me that you won't haul SI and the rest of the police in on everything. You can dig up information, use them discreetly, but you can't round up a posse and go gunning for demons. Her eyes narrowed. Why the hell not? Because bringing mortal authorities into a conflict is the nuclear assault of the supernatural world. No one wants to see it happen, and if they thought you might do it, they'd kill you. Or they'd pull strings higher up and get you fired or framed for something. They would never allow it to pass. You'd get yourself ruined or hurt or killed, and it's likely a lot of people would go down with you. I paused to let the words sink in and then asked, still want me to tell you? She closed her eyes for a minute and then added once, hit me. You're sure? Yeah. All right, I said. And I told Murphy all of it. It took a while. I told her about Justin and about Elaine. I told her about the supernatural forces and politics at play in and around the city. I told her about the war I'd started because of what the Red Court had done to Susan. I told her about the fairies and Rule's murder. And most of all, I told her about the White Council. Those spineless, arrogant, egomaniacal sons of bitches, Murphy growled. Who the hell do they think they are, selling out their own people like that? Some silent, delighted part of me let out a mental cheer at her reaction. She made a disgusted noise and shook her head. So let me get this straight, she said. You started a war between the Council and the Red Court. The Council needs the support of the fairies in order to have a chance of victory. But they can't get that support unless you find this killer and restore the stolen magical power thingy. Mantle, I interjected. Whatever, Murphy said. And if you don't get the magic, what's it, the Council fixes you up in a carry-out box for the vampires. Yeah, I said. And if you don't find the killer before midsummer, the fairies slug it out with each other. It could be bad, no matter who won.
It would make El Nino look as mild as an early spring thaw.
And you want my help? You've worked homicide before. You're better at it than me.
That goes without saying, she said, a trace of smile on her mouth.
Look, Harry, if you want to find out who did the killing, the best way to start is to figure out why.
Why what?
Why the murderer? Why Rule got bumped off?
Oh, right, I said.
And why would someone try to take you out in the park yesterday?
Could have been almost anyone, I said. It wasn't like it was a brilliant attempt as far as they go.
Wrong, Murphy said. Not neat, but not stupid either. After you called earlier tonight, I snooped around.
I frowned at her.
You found something?
Yeah. Turns out that there have been 2 armed robberies in the past 3 days. First outside of Cleveland, then at a gas station just this side of Indianapolis, coming toward Chicago.
That doesn't sound out of the ordinary.
No, Murphy said. Not unless you throw in that in both cases someone was grabbed at the scene and abducted. And both times the video security broke down just as the robbery started. Eyewitnesses in Indiana identified the perpetrator as a woman. I whistled.
Whew. Sounds like our ghoul, then.
Murph nodded, her lips pressed together.
Any chance those people she grabbed were alive?
I shook my head.
Not likely. She probably ate them.
A ghoul can go through 40 or 50 pounds of meat a day. She'll put whatever's left someplace where animals can get to it, cover her tracks. She nodded.
I figured.
The pattern matches several incidents over the past 20 years. It took me a while to piece it together, but something familiar has happened 3 times in connection with the operations of a contract killer who calls herself the Tigress. A friend of the FBI told me that they suspected her of a number of killings in the New Orleans area, and that Interpol thinks she's pulled jobs in Europe and Africa, too.
Hired gun, I said.
So, who did the hiring?
From what you've said, my money's on the vampires. They're the ones who benefit most from you being dead. If they punch your ticket, the council will probably sue for peace, right?
Maybe, I said, but I doubted it.
If that's what they had in mind, it's stupid timing. They Pearl Harbored a bunch of wizards somewhere in Russia 2 nights ago, and the council was pretty angry about it.
Okay. So, maybe they figure that if your investigation finds Rule's killer and gets the council brownie points with the fairies, they're in for a real fight. Killing you before that happened makes sense.
Except that when it went down, I wasn't involved in the investigation yet.
Murphy shook her head. I wish I could get you together with a sketch artist. Describe her.
Doubt it would help much. She was in makeup at first, and I didn't give her a second look. By the time I was paying attention, she mostly looked like something out of a Japanese horror cartoon.
She glanced down at her now cold coffee.
Not much we can do but wait, then. I've got a couple of sources trying to turn up more, but I wouldn't bet anything on them. I'll let you know.
I nodded. And even if we find her, it might not help with the fairy stuff.
Right, he said. Mind if I ask you a few questions? Maybe I'll see something you don't.
Okay.
This dreadlock chick, Mav, he said her name was.
Yeah.
How sure are you in your instinct about her? That she couldn't have done the murder, I mean.
It's pretty close to certain, but not completely.
I frowned thoughtfully.
No. Fairies are tricky that way. Not completely.
Murphy nodded. What about Mab?
I rubbed at my chin, feeling the beginnings of stubble. She never out and out denied responsibility for Rule's death, but I don't think she's the killer.
What makes you say that?
I don't know.
I do. She could have picked anyone she wanted to represent her interests, and she chose you. If she wanted to cover her tracks, it would make more sense for her to choose someone less capable and with less experience. She wouldn't have picked someone as stupidly stubborn as you.
I scowled. Not stupidly, I said. I just don't like to leave things undone.
Murphy snorted. You don't know the meaning of give up, dolt. You see my point?
Yeah, I guess it's reasonable.
So what about this summer girl?
I blew out of breath.
It doesn't seem to hang on her very well. She was kinder than any fairy I ever met. She could have been pretty darned unpleasant to me, but she wasn't.
What about the other mortal, then, the Winter Knight?
He's a violent, vicious heroin addict. I could see him tossing Rule down the stairs, sure, but I'm not sure he's savvy enough to have worked enough magic to steal the mantle. He was more of a plunder now and think later sort of guy. I shook my head. I've got 3 more fairies to talk to, though.
Summer Queen and both mothers, Murphy nodded. When will you see them? as soon as I work out how. The ladies are the closest to the mortal world. They aren't hard to find. The queens and the mothers, though, will live in the fairy proper. I'll have to go there to find a guide. Murphy lifted her eyebrows. A guide? I grimaced. Yeah, I don't want to, but it's looking like I'm going to have to pay my godmother a visit. Murphy quirked an eyebrow. Seriously? You have a fairy godmother? Long story, I said. Okay, I want to get moving. If you could... The store lights went out. All at once. My heart all but stopped. A second later, emergency lights came up and revealed a roiling cloud of silver-gray mist spreading into the store from the doors. The mist rolled over a startled cashier, and the woman slumped, her mouth slightly open and her eyes unfocused, staring. Good Lord, Murphy said softly. Harry, what's happening? I had already gotten out of the booth and grabbed the salt shaker from our table and the one next to it. Trouble, come with me. Chapter 19. At first I tried to circle around the exit doors, but the mist proved to be flowing in through them as well. Curse it! We can't get out that way. Murphy's face went more pale as a young man flung himself at the exit doors. The moment he hit the mist, his running steps faltered. He came to a halt, a puzzled expression on his face, and stared around him blankly as his shoulders slumped. Dear God, she whispered. Harry, what is that? Come on, to the back of the store, I said, and started running that way. I think it's a mind fog. You think? I scowled over my shoulder at Murphy. I've never seen this one before, just heard about them. They shut down your head, flatline your ability to remember things, scramble your thoughts. They're illegal. Illegal? Murphy yelled. Says who? Says the laws of magic, I muttered. You didn't say anything about the laws of magic, Murphy said. If we get out of here alive, I'll explain it to you sometime. We ran down a long aisle toward the back of the store, passing housewares, then seasonal goods on our left, while grocery aisles stretched out on our right. Murphy stopped abruptly, broke open the covering of a fire alarm, and jerked it down. I looked around hopefully, but nothing happened. Damn, Murphy muttered. Worth a try. Look, the people in the fog should be all right once it's gone. And whoever this is, they won't have any reason to hurt them once we're not around. We'll get out the back door and get away from here. Where are we going to go? I don't know, I confessed as I started moving again. But anywhere is better than where the bad guys chose to attack and have their pick of 100 hostages, right? Okay, Murphy said. Getting out of here is good. I bet the bad guys are counting on that, trying to flush us out into a dark alley. You carrying? Murphy was already drawing her gun from under her jacket, a well-used military-issue Colt 1911. Are you kidding? I noticed that her hands were shaking. New gun? Old reliable, she said. You told me magic can jam a flaky gun. Revolver would have been even better. Why don't I just throw rocks and sharp sticks while I'm at it, Tex? Auto bigot. I spotted an employees-only sign. There, I said, and went that way, out the back. We headed for the swinging doors under the sign. I hit them first, shoving them open. A gray wall of mist lay in front of me, and I leaned back, trying to stumble to a halt. If I let myself touch the mist, I might not have enough of my wits left to regret it. I stumbled a foot short of it and almost fell backward, but Murphy grabbed my shirt and jerked me sharply back. We both backed out into the store. Can't get out that way, Murphy said. Maybe they don't want to hurt you anywhere. Maybe they just want to gas you and kill you while you're down. I swept my gaze around the store. Cold, gray mist rolled forward, slow and steady, in every direction. Looks like, I said. I nodded down a tall, narrow aisle containing auto parts. Down there, quick. What's down there? Murphy asked. Cover. I have to get us a defense against that mist. We reached the open space at the end of the aisle, and I nodded to Murphy. Here, stop here, and stand close to me. She did, and I could see her shaking as she asked, Why? I looked up. The mist had reached the far end of the aisle and was gliding slowly down it. I'm going to put a circle that should keep it off us. Don't step out of it or let any part of you cross outside. Murphy's voice took on a higher, more tense pitch. Harry, it's coming. I twisted open both salt shakers and started pouring them out in a circle around us, maybe 3 feet across. As I finished the circle, I invested it with the slightest effort of will, of intent, and it closed with a sudden snap of silent, invisible energies. I stood up again, holding my breath, until the mist touched it a moment later. It rolled around the circle and stopped, as though a cylinder of plexiglass stood between it and us. Murphy and I both let out our breath in slow exhalations. "Wow," she said quietly. "Is that like a force field or something?" "Only against magical energies," I said, squinting around us. "If someone comes along with a gun, we're in trouble." "What do we do?" "I think I can protect myself if I'm ready to do it," I said. "But I need to set up a charm on you."
"A what?"
"Charm. Short-term magic." I fumbled at my shirt until I found a frayed thread and started pulling it out. "I need a hair." Murphy gave me a suspicious frown, but she reached under her hat and unceremoniously jerked out several dark gold hairs. I plucked them up and twisted them together with the strand of thread. "Give me your left hand." She did. Her fingers shook so hard I could feel it when I put my own around them.
"Murph," I said.
She kept looking up and down the aisle, her eyes a little wild.
"Karen."
She looked up at me. She looked very young, somehow. "Remember what I said yesterday," I said. "You're hurt, but you'll get through it. You'll be okay." She closed her eyes tightly.
"I'm scared. So scared I'm sick."
"You'll get through it."
"What if I don't?"
I squeezed her fingers. "Then I will personally make fun of you every day for the rest of your life," I said. "I will call you a sissy girl in front of everyone you know, tie frilly aprons on your car, and lurk in the parking lot at the CPD and whistle and tell you to shake it, baby, every single day." Murphy's breath escaped in something like a hiccup. She opened her eyes, and a mix of anger and wary amusement easing into them in place of the fear. "You do realize I'm holding a gun, right?"
"You're fine. Hold your hand still."
Though her fingers still trembled a little, the wild, panicked spasms had ceased. I wrapped the twist of hair and thread around her finger. Murphy kept on peering through the mist, her gun steady.
"What are you doing?"
"Enchantment like that mist is invasive," I said. "It touches you, gets inside you. So I'm setting you up with a defense. Left side is the side that takes in energy. I'm going to block that mist spell from getting into you. Tie a string around your finger so you won't forget." I tied the string in an almost complete knot so that it would only need a single tug to finish. Then I fumbled my penknife out of my pocket and pricked the pad of my right thumb. I looked up at Murphy, trying to clear my thoughts for the spell. She regarded me, her face pale and uncertain. "I've never really seen you, you know, do it before."
"It's okay," I told her. I met her eyes for a dangerous second. "I won't hurt you. I know what I'm doing."
She lifted the corner of her mouth into a quick smile that made her eyes sparkle. She nodded and returned to peering out through the mist. I closed my eyes for a moment and began gathering my focus for the spell. We were already within a circle, so it happened fast. The air tightened on my skin, and I felt the hairs along my arms rise as the power grew.
"Mimoretum," I murmured.
I tied off the improvised string and touched the bead of blood on my thumb to the knot.
"Defendeir memoreius."
The energy rushed out of me and into the spell, wrapping tight around the string and pressing against Murphy. A wave of goosebumps rippled up her arm, and she drew in a sudden harsh breath.
"Whoa."
I looked at her sharply. "Murph, you okay?" She blinked down at her hand and then up at me.
"Wow, yeah."
I nodded and took my pentacle out of my shirt. I wrapped it around my left hand, leaving a five-pointed star lying across my knuckles.
"Okay, we're pushing our luck. Let's hope this works and get the hell out of here." "Wait, you don't know if it'll work?"
"It should work. It ought to, in theory."
"Great. Wouldn't it be easier to stay here?"
"That's a joke, right?" Murph nodded.
"Okay, how will we know if it works?"
"We step outside the circle, and if we don't drift into la-la land," I said, "we'll know it worked." She braced her charmed hand on the butt of her gun.
"That's what I love about working with you, Dresden, the certainty."
I broke the circle with a shuffle of my foot and an effort of will. It scattered with a pressured sigh, and the gray mist slid forward and over us. It glided over my skin like a cold and greasy oil, something foul and cloying and vaguely familiar that made me want to start brushing it off. It wreathed up over my arms, prickles of distraction and disorientation crawling over my limbs. I focused on the pentacle on my left hand, the solid, cool weight of it, the years of discipline and practice that it represented. I pushed the clinging mist away from my sensations, deliberately excluding it from my perception by sheer determination. A ripple of azure static flickered along the chain of my amulet, flashed around the pentacle, then faded, taking with it the distraction of the mind fog. Murphy glanced back at me and said, voice low, "You okay? You look shaky for a second." I nodded. "I got it now. You okay?" "Yeah. It doesn't feel like anything." "Damn, I'm good. Sometimes. Go. Out through the garden center." Murphy had the gun, and she walked in front. I kept my eyes open on her flanks as she headed down an aisle. We passed a customer and an employee down a side aisle, pressed against a wall where they apparently tried to avoid the mist. Now they stood with a faintly puzzled expression on their faces, eyes not focused. Another shopper, an old man, stood in an aisle, swaying precariously on his feet. I stopped beside him and said quietly, "Sir, here, sit down for a minute," and helped him sit down before he fell. We went past another slackly staring employee, her blue smock marked with dirt stains and smelling of fertilizer, and headed for the doors leading out to the garden center. My memory screamed a sudden alarm at me, and I lurched forward, diving past Murphy and out into the mist-shrouded evening within the chain-link boundaries of the garden center. A hard, sudden weight hit me, driving my thighs and hips down to the floor. My head whiplashed against it a moment later, complete with a burst of phantom light and very real pain. I rolled as the employee we just passed reversed her grip on a wickedly sharp set of pruners and stabbed them down at me. I oozed to one side in a sluggish dodge. The steel tips of the tool tore through my shirt and some of my skin before biting into the concrete. I kept rolling and kicked at the woman's ankles. She avoided me with a kind of liquid agility, and I looked up into a human face of a ghoul assassin from a rain of toads. The tigress. She didn't look particularly pretty, or particularly exotic, or particularly anything. She looked like no one in particular. Medium height, medium build, no flattering curves, no outrageous flaws, no nothing. Medium brown hair of unremarkable cut and length. She wore jeans, a polo top, a Walmart smock, all very normal. The gun she started drawing from under the smock commanded attention, though. A revolver, snub-nosed, but it moved with a kind of weight that made me think high caliber. I started trying to pull a shield together, but the defense I'd been holding against the mist and the blow to my head tangled up the process slowed me down, not much, but enough to get me really dead. Murphy saved me. As the tigress brought the gun to bear on me, Murphy closed with her, trapping the ghoul's gun arm with her own and doing something with her left hand as she twisted her body at the hips, her strong legs spread wide. Murphy was a faithful practitioner of Aikido, and she knew about grappling. The tigress let out a shriek. Not a girly, "Wow, does that hurt?" shriek, but the kind of furious, almost whistling sound you expect from a bird of prey. There was a snapping, popping sound, then a clap of thunder, the roar of a discharged gun at close quarters, the sudden sharp smell of burnt powder, and the revolver went skittering free. The ghoul stabbed the pruners at Murphy, but she was already on the way out, grunting with effort, her entire attack one circle that sent the tiger stumbling away into a stand of large, potted ferns. Murphy spun to face the ghoul. She took a shooting stance and snarled, "Get on your face, on the floor! You're under arrest. You have the right to remain silent." The ghoul changed. Skin tore at the corners of her mouth as it dropped open and gaped nightmarishly wide, canines lengthening as her lips peeled away from her teeth. Her shoulders jerked and twisted, hunching up and growing wider at the same time. Her clothes stretched out while her body grew more hunched. Her fingers lengthened, talons extending from the tips until her hands were spread as wide as the lawn rakes on a display behind her, and the fetid smell of decay and worse flooded out. Murphy's face went bloodless as she stared at the transformation. If she'd been dealing with an armed thug, I think she would have been fine. But the ghoul wasn't, and she wasn't. I saw the fear come surging up through her, winding its way into her through the scars a maddened ghost had left in her spirit the year before. Panic hit her, and her breath came out in strangled gasps as a demon from a madman's nightmare clawed its way free of the bushes, spread its talons, and let out a rasping, quivering hiss. Murphy's gun started quivering, and the barrel jerked erratically left and right. I struggled to get on my feet and back into the game, but my ears still rang, and the constant pressure of the mist slowed me down. The tigress must have seen the terror that held Murphy.
A cop, eh? The ghoul rasped, drool foaming beneath its teeth dribbling down its chin. It started toward Murphy, claw tips dragging along the floor. Aren't you going to tell me that I have a right to an attorney?
Murphy let out a small, terrified sound, frozen in place, her eyes wide. It laughed at her.
Such a big gun for a sweet girl. You smell sweet. It makes me hungry.
It continued forward, laughter still kissing every word, its distorted, inhuman voice continuing in a steady murmur.
Maybe I should let you arrest me. Wait until we're in the car. If you smell that good, I wonder how good you taste.
I guess the ghoul shouldn't have laughed. Murphy's eyes cleared and hardened. The gun steadied, and she said, "Taste this, bitch." Murphy started shooting. The ghoul let out another shriek, this one full of surprise and pain. The bullets didn't drive her back. That's for comic books and TV. Real bullets just ripped through you like lead weights through cheesecloth. No gaping, bloody holes appeared in the ghoul's chest, but sudden flowers of scarlet sprayed out from her back, covering the potted ferns with bloody dewdrops. The ghoul threw her arms up and recoiled, turning, screaming, and threw herself at the ferns. Murphy kept shooting. The ghoul stumbled and dropped down amid the ferns, still kicking and struggling wildly, knocking pots over, breaking others, scattering vegetable matter and dirt all over the floor. Murphy kept shooting. The gun clicked empty, and the ghoul half-rolled onto her ruined back, the stolen blue smock now ripped with huge holes and soaked through with blood. The ghoul choked and gagged, scarlet trickling out of its mouth. She let out another hiss, this one bubbling, and held up her hands in supplication.
"Wait,"
she rasped.
"Wait, please. You win. I give up."
Murphy ejected the clip, put in a fresh one, and worked the slide on the gun. Then she took a shooting stance again and sighted down the barrel, her blue eyes calculating, passionless, merciless. She didn't see the sudden shadow against the mist to her right, huge and hulking, backlit by emergency lights at the other end of the garden center. I did, and I finally shoved my dazed self back to my feet. "Murph!" I shouted. "To your right!" Murphy's head snapped around, and she darted to her left, even as a garden hoe swept down and shattered against the concrete where she'd been standing. The ghoul scrambled back through the ferns and vanished into the mist, leaving blood smeared everywhere. Murphy backpedaled and shot at the form in the mist, then ducked as another arm swept a shovel in a scything arc that just missed her head. Grum the ogre rolled forward out of the mist in his scarlet-skinned, 12-foot-tall, hulking form, a shovel clenched in one fist. Without slowing a step, he scooped up a 20-gallon ceramic pot and threw it at Murphy like a snowball. She scooted back behind a stack of empty loading pallets, and the pot exploded against them. Magic would be useless against the ogre. I looked wildly around me, then seized a jumbo-sized plastic bag of round, tinted glass potting marbles. "Hey!" I shouted. "Tall, red, and ugly!" Grum's head spun around further than I would have thought possible with a neck that thick, and his already beady eyes narrowed even more. He let out a bellowing roar and turned toward me, his huge feet slamming down on the concrete. I tore open the bag and dumped it out toward him. Green-blue marbles spread over the floor in a wave. Grum's foot slammed down on several as he advanced, and I hoped for the best. Grum continued toward me, unslowed, but when his great foot lifted, I saw small circles of powdered glass on the ground. I snarled a curse and ran deeper into the garden center, Grum's footsteps heavy behind me. I heard Murphy shoot again, a pair of shots, and tried to keep a mental count of her rounds. 4 in the new clip? Did she have another reload? And how many rounds did that Colt hold, anyway? A sharper and more piercing report cracked through the area. Rifle fire. Murphy's Colt barked twice more, and she called,
"Harry! Someone's covering the exit with gunfire!"
"Kinda busy here, Murph," I shouted.
"What the hell is that thing?"
"Ferry," I shouted.
Grum was already trying to kill me, so there's no point in being diplomatic.
"It's a big, ugly ferry!"
I started swiping things off the shelves to crash in the aisle behind me. I'd gained some distance on Grum, but it could be that he just needed time to gather momentum. I heard him snarl again, and he took a swing with a shovel in his hand. He was short of me, and it whooshed loudly enough to make me flinch. I looked wildly for something made of steel to throw at the ogre or to defend myself with. The mist kept me from seeing more than a couple of yards ahead of me, and from what I could see, I was just heading deeper and deeper into the plant vending area. The smell of summer-heated greenery, of fertilizer and mild rot filled my nose and mouth. I rounded the end of the aisle and ducked through a narrow gate and out from under a canopy top that gave shade to this part of the garden center, into a roofless area bound by a high chain-link fence and filled with young trees and greenery standing in silent rows. I looked around wildly for a way out into the parking lot at large and checked out how close the ogre was, flicking a glance back over my shoulder. Grum stopped at the gate to the fenced area and, with a small smile on his lips, swung the gate shut. As I watched, he covered his hand with a plastic trash bag and bent the latch like soft clay. Metal squealed, and the gate fastened shut with no more effort than I would need to close a twist tie. My heart fell down through my stomach, and I looked around me. The chain-length fence was at least 9 feet high, with a strand of barbed wire at the top, meant to stop incursions of baby tree nappers, I guess. The second gate, much bigger, stood closed, and the latch had been twisted exactly like the other, warped closed. It was a neat little trap, and I'd been chased right into it. "Damn it," I said. Grum let out a grating laugh, though I could barely see anything but his outline several yards away in the mist.
"You lose, wizard."
"Why are you doing this?" I demanded. "Who the hell are you working for?"
"You got no guess," Grum said.
There was a note of casual arrogance to his voice.
"Gee, that's too bad. Guess you'll go to your grave not knowing."
"If I had a nickel for every time I heard that," I muttered, looking around me. I had few options. None of them were good. I could open a way into the Never Never and try to find my way through the spirit realm and back into the real world somewhere else. But if I did that, not only might I run into something even worse than I already had in front of me, but if I got unlucky, I might hit a patch of slower time and not emerge back into my Chicago for hours, even days. I might also be able to melt myself a hole in the fence with conjured flame, providing I didn't burn myself to a cinder doing it. I didn't have my blasting rod with me, and without it, my control would be shaky enough to manage just that. I could probably pile a bunch of baby trees, loading pallets, sacks of potting soil, and so on, against the outer wall of the chain-link fence and climb out. I might get cut up on the barbed wire, but hell, that would be better than staying here. Either way, there was no time to waste standing around deciding. I turned toward the nearest set of young trees, picked up a couple, and tossed them against the fence.
"Murphy! I'm stuck, but I think I can get clear. Get out of here now!"
Murphy's voice floated to me, directionless in the fog.
"Where are you?" "Hell's bells, Murph! Get out!"
Her gun barked twice more.
"Not without you!"
I threw more stuff on the pile.
"I'm a big boy. I can take care of myself."
I took a long step up onto the pile and tested my grip. It was enough to let me reach the top. I figured I could pull myself up and worry about the barbed wire when I got there. I started climbing out. I was looking at a face full of barbed wire and pushing at the fence with my toes when I felt something wrap around my ankles. I looked down and saw a branch wrapped around my legs. I kicked at it irritably. And then as I watched, another branch lifted from the pile and joined the first, then a third, and a fourth. The branches beneath my feet heaved, and I suddenly found myself hauled up into the air, swinging upside down from my heels. It was an awkward vantage point, but I watched as the trees and plants and soil I'd thrown into a pile surged and wreathed together. The young trees tangled their limbs together, growing before my eyes as they did, lengthening and growing thicker to become part of a larger whole. Other bits of greenery, clumps of dirt, and writhing vines and leaves joined the trees, whipping through the air apparently of their own volition and adding to the mass of the thing that held me. It took shape and stood up, an enormous creature of vaguely human shape made all of earth and root and bough, twin points of brilliant emerald green light burning in its vine-wreathing, leaf-strewn head. It had to have been 9 or 10 feet tall and nearly that far across. Its legs were thicker than me, and branches spread out above its head like vast horns against the background of luminous mind fog. The creature lifted its head and screamed, a sound of tortured wood and creaking limb and howling wind. "Stars and stones, Harry," I muttered, my heart pounding. "When will you learn to keep your mouth shut?" Chapter 20.
"Murphy," I screamed, "get clear!"
The plant monster... No, wait, I couldn't possibly refer to that thing as a plant monster. I'd be a laughingstock. It's hard to give a monster a cool name on the spur of the moment, but I'd used a name I'd heard Bob throw out before. The Chlorofiend lifted me up and shook me like a set of maracas. I focused on my shield bracelet, running my will, bolstered by sudden fear, through the focus. My skin tingled as the shield formed around me, and I shaped it into a full sphere. I was barely in time. The Chlorofiend threw me at a post in the chain-link fence. Without the shield, it would have broken my back. I slammed into it, feeling the energy of the shield tighten around me, spreading the impact over the whole of my body instead of solely at the point of impact. The shield transferred the portion of kinetic energy of impact into heat and light, while the rest came through as an abrupt pressure. The result was like a sudden suit of oven-warmed elastic closing on me, and it felt about 3 sizes too small. It knocked the wind out of my lungs. Azure and argent light flashed in a vague sphere around me. I didn't bounce much, just fell to the concrete. The shield gave out a more feeble flash when I hit. I got up off the ground and dodged away from the Chlorofiend, but it followed me, slapping aside a stand of wooden tomato stakes with one leafy arm. Its glowing green eyes blazed as it came. I ran up against the fence at the back end of the lot, and the Chlorofiend's huge fist smashed down at me again. I lifted my shield bracelet against it, but the blow tossed me 12 feet down the length of the fence and into a set of huge steel partitioned shelves holding hundreds of 50-pound bags of mulch, potting soil, and fertilizer. I lay there dazed for a second, staring at an empty aisle display proclaiming in huge scarlet letters, "Weed be gone, only $2.99. I clutched at a display and got to my feet in time to duck under the Chlorofiend's fist as it punched at my head. It hit one of the metal shelves instead of me, and there was a shriek of warping metal, a creaking yowl of pain from the fiend, and a burst of sizzling smoke. The creature drew its smoking fist back and screeched again, eyes blazing, even brighter, angrier. "Steel," I muttered. "So you're a fairy something or other, too." I looked up at the enormous shelves as I ran down the length of them, and a second later I heard the Chlorofiend turn and begin pacing after me. I started gathering in my will as I ran, and I allowed the physical shield to fall, leaving me only enough defense to keep the mist from blitzing my head. I would need every bit of strength I could muster to pull off my sudden and desperate plan. And if it didn't work, my shield wouldn't protect me for long in any case. Sooner or later, the Chlorofiend would batter its way through my defenses and pound me into plant food. I pulled ahead of it, but it started gaining momentum, catching up to me. As I reached the end of the row, the end of the steel shelves, I turned to face it. Hell's bells, that thing was big. Bigger than Grum. I could see through it in places, where twists of branches and leaves were not too closely clumped with earth, but that didn't make it any less massive or dangerous. If this didn't work, I wasn't going to last long enough to regret it. Most magic is pretty time-consuming, what with drawing circles and gathering energies and aligning forces. Quick and dirty magic, evocation, is drawn directly from a wizard's will and turned loose without benefit of guide or limit. It's difficult, and it's dangerous. I suck at evocation. I only knew a couple I could do reliably, and even they require a focus, such as my shield bracelet or blasting rod, to be properly controlled. But for doing big, dumb things that require a lot of energy and not much finesse, I'm usually fine. I lifted my arms, and the mist was stirred by a sudden rush of moving air. The chlorophene pounded closer, and I closed my eyes, pouring more energy out, reaching for the wind.
Vento,